Okay, I'm going to try to talk a little bit about the relationship between robustness and complexity in the context of biological systems. And my research interests are probably a little different than most of the speakers here. I'm interested in networks sort of generally, both biological regulatory networks and then engineering networks. And I'm mostly a mathematician, so I'm interested in particularly new mathematics and algorithms that arise that are driven by these kinds of problems. This is the people I work with on these various problems. So some of them are here. Adam Arkin's here, Gene Carlson's here, Peng Zhao's here. So many of them are here at Santa Barbara. So I made a little web page that has some papers that if you want to read more about this. In particular, I'm going to talk about chemotaxis and heat shock and E. coli, and there's a paper on each of those topics on this website, and it's accessible from my homepage. And then there's also bigger context in terms of the sort of hot theory and power laws and that subject, which is work with Gene Carlson, and then some papers on web and internet traffic, and protocol design, and then some recommended books if you want to get some background. I think this, in terms of biology, this is a really great book. I would highly recommend this book as a background for this talk. And then if you want some engineering background, those books are. If you want sort of an example of sort of what the state-of-the-art research is in the mathematics behind what I'm talking about, there's a thesis also there. It's just an example. This is if you're really masochistic, you might want to take a look at that. So what I want to try to talk about today, and this is Adam Arkin, this is a slide stolen from Adam Arkin, which he stole from somebody else, Peter Karp, I guess. This is a diagram of the mass transfer in the metabolism of E. coli. And so what each red dot is a metabolite, and each line is a catalyzed reaction. So more or less, each line is an enzyme. Although some enzymes have multiple uses. Now, that's one way to draw the diagram. There's another way to draw the diagram, which would include all the regulatory interactions, all the feedback loops that control this network. And you never see that diagram drawn, because if you did, it would be just solid black with lines. You couldn't draw the diagram. But there's so many lines that the whole thing just turns black, so nobody even tries to draw the diagram. And it's the diagram on the right that I want to try to get us to understand. Why is it so complicated? So we think the thing on the left is complicated, but it's trivial in complexity compared to the diagram on the right, which of course no one ever draws. So the diagram on the left is as complicated as it is because it has to supply materials and energy for the cell. So it has to, the reason you have all these different, it needs all these metabolites, it has to make them, it has to make energy, and it has to convert, it has to use nutrients from the environment to both create the materials needed for the cell and to generate the energy for the cell. So we understand why this network is as complicated as it is. It supplies materials and energy. What does the network on the right supply? Well, it supplies robustness. And what I mean by that? Well, if we would go in and knock out parts of this network, what the organism would lose is the ability to make those metabolites. And if you replace them, then presumably the organism would be still viable. If you knock out the network elements on the right, what you lose is robustness. That is, the organism will still work in ideal circumstances in a laboratory, but there will be some fluctuations in the environment that it will not be robust to. It will not do as well in a fluctuating environment without the extra network. And so most of the complexity of an E. coli, and certainly us, is these regulatory networks. These are either sensors, actuators, or the feedback loops that connect them, that regulate the underlying networks. And the basic networks themselves that supply materials and energy are relatively trivial. Even this network on its left is as complicated as it is, because the E. coli can switch from using a variety of different nutrients in order to make materials and energy. So in fact, you could get a much simpler network over here and still have viable life. So even this network is mostly about robustness of the supply of materials and energy. The network on the right is entirely due to robustness. So basically, you could remove the entire network on the right and most of the network on the left and still have a viable organism, provided you grew it in a sufficiently benign environment. Well, there's organisms that have 500 genes.
No, but the idea...
Obligate parasites.
The idea that most of the regulatory circuits are just there to supply robustness, and you could strip a large number of them away and still have viability under optimal land conditions. Right? I mean, as a biologist, I actually would be surprised if that was true. Right? I mean,
So you can knock out, you can knock out any elements, and it's still viable. So if you knock out any elements, that hasn't been done experimentally. But there are organisms in which all of it is removed, and they're obligate parasites, and they rely on their hosts to provide the regulation that they no longer provide. So mycoplasma with 500 genes would have part of this network and none of that. Now, not exactly the same network, but pretty close, right? So there exist organisms that are what you might imagine to be a simplified version of this. Now, what hasn't been done is biologists haven't taken an E. coli and knock out 3,500 genes to make a mycoplasma.
I guess the argument I would make very strongly for that is it would be impossible to do that.
Without changing some of the... You'd have to make some modifications to the proteins that resulted, presumably. You'd have to make some modifications to the genes. Pure knockouts probably wouldn't work. Here's what's certainly true. Knock out any part of this, and all you lose is robustness. Now the question is, how much could you continue to knock out? That's a conjecture. Yeah. But there certainly are organisms that are simpler than this, that are completely viable. And they have pretty homologous to this network. Little tweaks, relatively small tweaks to get there. So you might have to tweak it a bit. Yeah, you're right. I mean, in detail, and it's not clear. It's conceivable that you could just flat out knock the whole thing out and you would have a still viable organism. So the point of this is that the complexity of biology is essentially robustness. Now, I don't mean those are the same things. What I mean is that they're so intertwined that you can't think about complexity without thinking about robustness. So one of the things I want to talk about with respect to this is this apparent paradox, which is not really one, it's only superficially one, is that we already know that Darwinian evolution uses selection on random mutations to create this kind of enormous complexity we see. Most of us believe this. Some don't, but most of us. I assume everybody in the room believes this. What's interesting is there's lots of other scenarios, lots of other aspects of biology in which, what you have here is you have a process that in which most mutations are not beneficial. So most of the behavior of mutation on its own is not beneficial. But when hooked up with selection, over the long run, produces remarkable robustness and complexity. Well, you have a whole bunch of other mechanisms which on their own produce gratuitous amounts of uncertainty. By what I mean by gratuitous, I just mean if you look at the behavior of the components in isolation, they seem to generate an enormous amount of behavior that is useless. Just like mutation generates an enormous amount of mutations that are not advantageous, are useless. So the process of transcription and translation, very stochastic, by itself, once it's initiated, the amount of product can vary by orders of magnitude within the same system. Microtubules just go all over the place, willy-nilly. Neurogenesis, huge number of connections that are never used. Angiogenesis, same thing. The immune system makes this enormous diversity of responses that are never used. Chemotaxis, which we'll talk about, random walking, most of the directions useless. Yet, when connected with the appropriate regulatory feedback, this process produces very robust systems at a higher level. Okay. So, we want to understand, why is it that biology opts for these gratuitously uncertain and gratuitously complex networks? Since there are simpler ways to do all of this. There are simpler, easier, more straightforward ways to do this. And biology doesn't choose the simpler ways, it chooses these complex ways. Perhaps it's an evolutionary accident. So these kinds of feedback strategies appear throughout biology and advanced technology, and that's one of the things I want to try to connect with. Now, Gerhardt and Kirshner talk a lot about this. And they emphasize that this exploratory behavior, that is, the components explore many more behaviors than are ultimately useful. And these are pruned back through a feedback regulatory process to get just the behavior you want. Is ubiquitous in biology. It's everywhere in biology. But they claim it's rare in our machines, and this is one of the bizarre things that I experience I've had in reading their papers and their books, is you read something and go, oh man, that's exactly how engineers do it. And then their next sentence is, nothing like this occurs in machines. And you go, well, and so my guess is, I haven't actually had a chance to talk to them, I think they have a sort of 17th century view of engineering, where they think of engineering as building these little sort of clockwork devices that are very fragile, and the parts have to be really precisely machined. And of course, they don't actually think about how their watch works, or their car works, or the airplanes they fly in works, or the internet works, because of course, no one knows how their watch works, and if you look under the hood of your car, you go, I have no idea how this works, and no one can fix their car anymore. And so advanced technologies are so cryptic that I don't think anybody actually knows how they work. And so it's not surprising that they don't realize that, in fact, advanced technologies are exactly the same as this. So they're right about primitive technologies, but they're not about advanced technologies. And so it turns out there's a clear explanation as to why this is true. Now, the challenge is, can I make that clear, you know, in the time we have? And I will give it my best shot. So the motivation here is I'm going to try to continue themes that have already been, I think, as far as I can tell, I haven't actually been to any of the talks in this program, but I think I'm continuing themes that are already discussed in this program. And so, but my take on it is going to be to think about it this way. Suppose if we didn't have lots of engineering theory and mathematics, reverse engineering of the existing complex engineering systems around us would be absolutely impossible. So for example, this laptop. If I tried to just use modeling and simulation alone to understand this laptop, it would be utterly hopeless. Because we know where every transistor and every capacitor and every wire, exactly how this laptop was manufactured. So we could write down differential equations describing the whole thing. And that would be an utterly hopeless, absolutely useless endeavor on its own. If we didn't understand the architectural principles or the design principles, you would simulate and simulate and simulate, and what you would produce is interesting phenomena, but you would never get a laptop. Why should we expect biology to be a lot easier than that? I'm not claiming it's easier, but we wouldn't expect biology to be a lot easier to reverse engineer than the engineering artifacts that we can build, such as this laptop. Now, the complexity of this laptop in terms of part count is probably higher than the E. coli. Just look at the number of elements and stuff like that. It's substantially more complicated than E. coli. But I don't think it's more complex in a sense of how hard to reverse engineer it is. So we wouldn't expect either of these strategies to be successful. So in particular, we wouldn't expect a research program that tried to find the gene responsible for this slide. Right? You wouldn't expect there to be, a single transistor. You wouldn't expect there to be a single transistor that produced this slide, right? And you would get cryptic things if you started knocking out transistors and trying to map it into into slides, okay. Although that's a good place to start. I mean, that's not a bad place to start. The other thing is you wouldn't expect this slide to emerge in some mystical way from some random collection of silicon and metal at some critical point or phase transition or bifurcation or edge of anything. Okay, so these are things that you wouldn't expect to work on the laptop, and so of course, and again, biologists don't expect this to work in biology either.
Can I just ask a question
yeah.
about the argument of exploration and selection for geobotanists about that kind of modern technology work? So if I look at my very cheap wristwatch, if I literally apply the idea of exploration and selection, I would argue that the oscillator varies over some frequency stochastically, and then it picks out the right frequency to run it. Right? That's what I would think of.
Yeah, and that's not the right way to think about it.
Okay.
So what I think about it is take most of the part, well, we'll talk about this in some detail.
Okay.
But in the case of your wristwatch, I mean, it's built out of the sloppiest, cheapest CMOS you can find. And so if you look at the chip level analog behavior of your watch, it's garbage. Okay. Yet, as a whole system, it works quite robustly. And so what are the architectures that allow for that?
Right, but I guess, so robustness, like by exploration and selection, which is what you were arguing in the previous slide.
No, what I'm arguing is that gratuitous uncertainty and gratuitous complexity, so that the individual behaviors of individual components are much more diverse and uncertain than is required for the system level behavior that systematically is done in biology, systematically done in engineering.
Right. I guess that maybe the point that I'm trying to figure out whether you're arguing they missed the boat on is biology depends on that uncertainty and selecting from within that uncertainty. Now,
engineering does too. We'll get to that. Yeah, we'll get to that. That's exactly what I want to try to get an understanding of. So now, it turns out with respect to engineering theory, when we say, well, what kind of theory is there around to help us with this, it turns out there's too much, not too little. And let me try to explain what I mean by that. There's been two great abstractions in engineering theory in the 20th century. One is to separate the problem of systems engineering, the integrating of large systems, into control, communications, and computing, and doing them separately, both in theory, so the theoreticians that work on these things, and the people who build the systems, have these things separate. And then, to abstract all of that away from the physical substrate. So if you would do control, communications, or computing, you don't care if underneath there's fiber optics, silicon, or, you know, ox carts carrying stones around. It's all abstracted into information and feedback and aspects of computation, these all abstract models. So this was a tremendously successful strategy. So what we see as the explosion in technology in the last half of the 20th century is largely due to our ability to manufacture novel materials and devices that creates the physical substrate, and then put them together to make interesting systems using the understanding that we got from these abstractions. What it's created, though, is sort of this Tower of Babel in which the devices and materials people have no idea what the systems people are doing, and vice versa. And people in control, communications, and computing can't read each other's papers. So if this is going to be relevant to biology, we've got to try to do something about that. Because if they can't understand each other, how can anybody expect from the outside to understand collectively what this theory is about? So the issues for theory are you want to have rigor, you want to have relevance, and you want to have accessibility. So we've had spectacular success in the first two, very little success in the last one. Now perhaps it's impossible to go for all three. So far there isn't an all three. The attempts to do just the third haven't been terribly successful, and pretty much biologists can ignore them. So what I'm going to try to do is try to tell you something that's not easily obtained elsewhere, from the papers online, other talks, and so on. So what I'm going to try to do is talk about biology with some perspectives from math and engineering, and talk about robustness and complexity. So I'm going to try to use minimal math details, but still suggestive of what is possible. The papers online go into as much detail as you want. And I'm going to try to use hopefully familiar example systems. These are not ideal example systems. Certainly from engineering, I'd prefer to use a little more sophisticated engineering examples, because the ones I will use are not the best. But what they are is they're things that you can visualize easily. So for example, internet is probably one of the better examples, and that would take too long to, if you don't already know what the product protocols work. So the caveat is that the real thing is a lot more complicated in this little story, and I'm not a biologist, and in fact, I'm not really an engineer. I'm really a mathematician who is interested in systems engineering issues. And it's possible that any simple story is just hopelessly misleading. It may be that there aren't simple stories that really explain the essence of biology. And then biology is very, very unlike physics. And it may be that it's intrinsically unlike it. And it may be that both engineering and biology, advanced technologies and biological systems, there aren't simple stories. So I'm hoping that there are, and I'm going to try to tell you ones. You can decide whether this ends up simple. So part of the problem in using all these ideas from engineering is it's extraordinarily cryptic. And we don't really notice how complex our technologies are until they don't work, until something happens, right? So we just merrily go along. We have all this fabulous capability. And then the other problem is there are people who understand all this stuff, but the fact that I'm here talking to you about it should make you suspicious. People will talk about good ideas, but no one talks about great ideas. They're busy making money. Okay. So you should view me with some suspicion that I'm actually here talking to largely a group of physicists about biology. Should make you suspicious, given that I'm not a biologist and neither are you, for the most part. So what I want to talk a little bit about, one of the examples I want to talk about is E. coli heat shock. And we'll try to talk through this problem a little bit. And again, this is a complex feedback system that seems gratuitously complex and also gratuitously uncertain. So what's the problem here? Well, suppose you got a cell. If the temperature in the environment goes up, the temperature in the cell goes up. Proteins unfold. They form aggregates. And collectively, that causes a loss of protein function. Okay. Then eventually, the networks that the proteins are building start failing. And then eventually, you have cell death. So it's this cascading event. Okay. And so then you... That's sort of indicating it turned brown and died. Okay. So how does the cell build barriers? So imagine this cascading event. You can try to stop it at any point. One of the things you can do is you can insulate and then internally regulate your own temperature. That's one of the things we do. And then the temperature in the cell doesn't change. So that's a first line of defense for us. The E. coli don't have that line of defense. They're too small. So they can thermotax. They run away from the heat or the cold. They will thermotax. They will swim to a place where the temperature is what they'd like. Now, we'll get back to thermotaxis and chemotaxis and how that's done later. You could build more robust proteins. Simply make the proteins more robust. Now, where are you building the barrier? The barrier now is in an energy profile to the process of unfolding due to the thermodynamic fluctuations. So this is doable. And for most of the proteins that are denaturing, you can make modest changes in them and cause them to be more temperaturally stable. That's quite doable. And there are homologs of all the proteins that are denaturing that exist in thermophilic organisms. You can also have multiple either allelic or paralogous variants. So what I mean by that is if you have different alleles in the population, then the populations can adapt on reproductive timescales. And so you'll find some organisms that have different alleles dominating in different parts of the world, whether they live in hot or cold areas. Or you could add multiple proteins within the same organisms that are regulated. That would allow the individual to adapt on the time scale of transcription and translation mechanisms. So here's what E. coli does in terms of growth. It's optimal between about 37 and 42 degrees. This linear plot, I'm plotting minus 1 over t versus growth, and that growth is really basically this Arrhenius chemistry, right? That's just the speed up that you get through to chemistry. Now, if you didn't have the heat shock response, which had this regulatory mechanism, it would have a growth curve with the dotted red, but it gets this extension of a substantial amount due to this thing called the heat shock response, which we'll talk about a bit. So there seems to be some sort of trade-off in. So there's organisms that have different curves. But the biochemists, and I think this is again a situation that is apparently controversial. Some biochemists say, "Oh, we know exactly what's going on here," and other people, Adam is, for example, an example of someone who's suspicious of this argument. But the argument goes like this: we could build an organism that would look like the one in yellow, that would have a higher range, and work at and its proteins. Basically, you build take the same E. coli and tweak its proteins, and people who work in bioengineering do this, to make the proteins not denature. And then you could build an organism like the one in yellow that would be like an E. coli, but it would just work at higher temperatures. The argument is the price you would pay is at 37 degrees, you'd lose a little bit of performance. And since that's the optimal growth conditions for them, the yellow organism in the life cycle of the E. coli would lose out to the blue organism. So you can build yellow, but blue is the one that wins. Now, that's controversial, it's not clear, but the argument's clear. What the argument being made is that if you make a more robust protein, you pay a little performance penalty at 37 degrees in order to have it work at higher degrees. Conjecture. But that's what Stryer would say. So the last strategy is you can try to refold the denatured proteins. And that's what this regulatory mechanism does. So the heat shock response to refold denatured proteins involves complex feedback and feed-forward networks. So there's all these alternative strategies. You can build robust proteins, you can regulate temperature, you can thermotacks, and you do this heat shock response. It's interesting that biology, and again advanced technology, overwhelmingly opts for this complex control system instead of just building the robust components. Why don't we just make robust proteins? End of story. Okay? Again, always seems to, you can find robust protein stories, but they seem to be rare, whereas these strategies are all extraordinarily common. Particularly regulating temperature makes almost no sense except for robustness. It's just a big waste of energy to have these big brains and regulate our temperatures. That's insane. It's a huge waste of energy. Why in the world would biology choose to do this? Well, presumably it gives us more flexibility. We're more mobile, we're more adaptable, we're more robust, in a we're able to take advantage of fluctuations in our environment that a cold-blooded, smaller-brained organism would not. Yep.
And then you make them stick.
That's the argument. That's exactly the argument. That's exactly the argument for the yellow versus the blue. Yes, that's exactly the argument.
You don't have a very wide range of activity over a wide range of temperature.
So I think it's still controversial. I like this argument because it fits sort of the story, but I think people who Adam would say maybe it sounds like it's not an internally inconsistent or irrational claim. It's just one that would need more verification. But I basically believe it, that's the argument. So I want to talk a little about this network. So how does this network work? Well, basically, so I'm going to try to see if I can explain how this thing works briefly. So sigma 32 is the sigma factor associated with making the heat shock or the molecular chaperones in E. coli. So what do molecular chaperones do? Molecular chaperones, and particularly this DNAK, is a protein that grabs proteins as they come out of the ribosome, grabs unfolded proteins, and folds them. And some small proteins it actually folds and then lets go. Other small protein or larger proteins it grabs, and then the problem is the environment of the cell is all cramped. Okay, so you get pulled out of this ribosome and you're this unfolded protein. And if you were just in water or something, you just fold. But you're all jammed in all this stuff, and you're trying to fold, and you can't fold, right? And so these chaperones help you. They go, oh, you're not folded. I'll help you fold. They grab you. They try to help you fold. And then if you don't fold, they find these barrels, these grow L, grow S things. They're sort of like big barrels, and they stuff you in this barrel and put this lid on. And then you're in this barrel, and you're all by yourself. And you can kind of relax, and you can fold, okay? So that's what these chaperones do, and they do it all the time because of the tight confines of the cell. You need these chaperones. Without these chaperones, the cell doesn't work because the proteins just come out unfolded, and then they just kind of sit there, okay? So what happens is when you heat, things start unfolding when you don't want them to. They're just out in the cytoplasm, and they just start unfolding. So you have lots of unfolded proteins. So the chaperones now have to not just fold ribosome, you know, the things coming out of the ribosomes, but they have to fold proteins that are denaturing after they fold it. So they fold and then they denature, and so then the chaperones have to grab them and fold them. Okay. So how does sigma 32 work? Well, sigma 32 is the sigma factor for creating the chaperones. So it has a feedback loop, and the feedback loop is, it's got hydrophobic residues that make it look like an unfolded protein. So it's lying around in the cell, and it looks like an unfolded protein. So this DNAK grabs it and tries to fold it. Okay. So if there's plenty of chaperones around, the sigma 32 is all bound up with DNAK, with the chaperones. Okay, because the chaperones are sitting around, they see all the sigma 32, they grab it, and they try to fold it. So if there's plenty of chaperones, the sigma 32 is all bound up. If the chaperones get busy with other proteins, then the sigma 32 gets released, it binds the RNA polymerase, and starts making more chaperones. So that's a feedback process. Notice that the sigma 32, by mimicking the characteristics of unfolded proteins, is a sensor for unfolded proteins. So that's a feedback loop on unfolded proteins. Very effective one. Okay? So that's one part. So that's a feedback system. And it uses this transcriptional process that, as we said, is very stochastic. But because of this feedback loop, and actually because of some degradation, which I'm not going to talk about, this feedback loop actually produces a very reliably regulated level of chaperones, appropriate for the temperature level. So there's very few sigma 32s in a cell. There's lots of chaperones. And so this is, again, piece by piece, there's gratuitous uncertainty out, you know, all over the place, but connected with feedback like this, produces very robust behavior. There's one other cool thing that this thing does, is if the cell starts getting heated, the sigma 32 doesn't wait for proteins to denature. It has various mechanisms with respect to the stability of its mRNA and also probably for the stability of its degradation. So that as soon as the heat happens, so sort of think of this from a design point of view. As soon as the heat happens, you know proteins are going to start denaturing. So what you would do is you would design a feed-forward system which directly sensed heat and upregulated the chaperones without waiting for the denaturing to happen. So that would be an extra layer of feedback that you would put in. And it's actually feed forward, it's not feedback. So again, how does it do that? Well, there's various mechanisms it could do that with. It probably uses them all. You could have the mRNA be destabilized by heat, so it forms these hairpins so that it won't translate. So you can do translational control. Or you can vary the rate of degradation as a function of heat. So the amount of sigma 32 could be affected directly by heat. And then the amount of free sigma-32 available to bind RNA polymerase would depend on the amount of denatured proteins. So again, this is exactly how we design control systems. So if you have, and we'll talk about airplanes in a minute, and we'll talk about how airplanes actually use both of these. So the feedback would be the response to the internal characteristics that you want to control. And then feed forward is there anything you can sense in your environment that will tell you in advance that something's bad is going to go wrong, and you take an action in advance of something bad going wrong. So this is exactly how an engineer would design it, and the cool thing is the Sigma 32 functions as this very multi-purpose sensor. So we're starting to build cars that have this sort of complexity of feedback. Let me talk a little bit, let me just show you sort of an example, sort of a technological example that is similar in flavor to this cascading failure event. So suppose you're driving along, and what happens is you get in a dangerous situation, and then you crash, and then you have contact with your car, and then you have trauma. So this is a cascading event that could be stopped at many levels. You could put lanes, laws, lights, ramps. That all takes normal situations and keeps them from getting dangerous, keeps us apart. These are all barriers that keep us from getting into dangerous situations. Once situations become dangerous, we have anti-lock brakes to keep us from skidding when we stop, and advanced vehicles are starting to have even active collision avoidance using radar. Once a crash happens, you can have lots of heavy metal around you, so you get a big SUV. That keeps the crash from propagating to you. You can have seat belts to keep you having contact with a car, and you can have airbags. And finally, you could wear a helmet, and then finally, you could have ambulances and doctors and so on to deal with further cascading events. So let's look at airbags. So what airbag is, they have their own state space. So this is a very abstract state space of vehicle driving. Okay, it's a finite automata, totally abstract view of it. So you have your own state space for airbags. They sit there and they sense accelerations that are excessive and deploy. Then you have contact with the airbag, and that causes trauma. Hopefully less than the other trauma. So here's the full state space of the combined airbag vehicle system. So here's what happens as you start towards a crash, and what you want is you want the airbag to sense that you're in a crash situation, deploy the airbag, you have contact with the airbag instead of the car. As a consequence, there's a barrier that's kept you from getting over to the right-hand side, the bad side of the diagram. The difficulty with it is, in rare circumstances, the airbag will deploy when it shouldn't. And then you will get trauma due to the airbag. So you could actually be killed sitting in a parking lot. Very unlikely, but possible. If that happens on the freeway when you're going 70 miles an hour, then you will actually, you now have a new route to die that you didn't have before. So in fact, you've fixed one problem and you've created a new one. It's a win, because the problem you fixed is much more likely than the problem you created. Okay? So this is good. So we've made a robust system that's also fragile. It's fragile in new ways, robust to things that you would like to be, and it's a good thing. This is a good design. And then you got to make sure that this is rare. So you make sure you don't deploy spuriously. So you make a lot of effort to make sure that the accelerometer in your airbag doesn't spuriously deploy the airbag. That would be a really big problem. And then, of course, you have to worry about children sitting in the front seat. Oh, boy, we have to put them in the back seat. There's all sorts of things you have to do now to make sure that this doesn't happen and cause more trouble than you started with. So far, 2,000 lives have been saved in the U.S. because of the robust. 50 lives have been lost due to this. It's a win, unless you're the parent of one of the children that are the 50, and then, of course, you think it's horrible. And it should be fixed. So this is a feature of complexity that I think is most striking. The robust uncertainties that are common, that you design for, or in the case of biology, you've evolved to handle, but often fragile otherwise. So now humans supply actually most of the collision avoidance processes here. We're going to build automated systems. And if we deploy an automated system, that system will be orders of magnitude more complex than the transportation system that exists now. So we think about how complex our automobiles are, how our freeways are, our lights, our on-ramps, our off-ramps, all that kind of stuff. Trivial in complexity compared to a fully automated system, which we'll eventually have. Superficially, that system will be much simpler. You'll just get on your cell phone and, I mean, who knows, you'll say, okay, or you tell your PDA that you've got to go home. And you walk outside and a car's there and you get in the car and you go home. And you don't drive, you don't think, you don't have to do anything, you just go from point to point. So it's going to seem incredibly simple. But it will be orders of magnitude more complex internally. So that's the point, is that simplicity superficially in all of our technology hides enormous complexity. So when we look at systems and look at their basic functionality, and then we think about what happens when we put that functionality in the world. We have basic functionality, and we have all these things. Remember that original picture we talked about is all these networks that create robustness. And the problem is this is not the way that this picture is not to scale. That's how it ought to look in advanced technologies and in biology. So the basic functionality almost doesn't matter. So it almost doesn't matter whether I'm talking about an E. coli or an advanced transportation system or the internet. The basic functionality is almost lost in the complexity of all the things that you have to do for regulatory feedback networks. Of course, if you put a microscope on that part, it can look pretty big. And if you put a big microscope on it, you can sort of think, gosh, that's all there is. All I have to worry about is this stuff. And I think that's kind of what science has been about, and I think biology is really prepared to do something different. So what does all this stuff do? Well, it has to sense, it has to communicate, and it has to make control decisions. So what are the theoretical foundations for this? Well, there's control theory. There's information theory and there's computational complexity. And as I said, these have been isolated, separate disciplines. That's going to have to change. It's going to have to change for engineers because we're building systems that require it to change. But it's going to have to change for biology. Dynamical systems, statistical physics have a little something to say. I've been very disappointed as I've learned more biology how boring biology is from a dynamical systems point of view. I was really looking forward to biology using a lot more non-trivial attractors. Point attractors, homeostatic regulation. Lots of cases where that isn't the case, but that's because those are the things, again, you see and you're drawing your attention to. It's like in your automobile. First thing you notice is these wheels going around. And then if you notice these pistons going around. But if you actually check the complexity of your modern automobile, it's all those computers and stuff inside that are basically doing set point regulation to keep all that stuff going. Interestingly, I guess this program is in statistical physics and biology. And now that I kind of have started learning a little more statistical physics, I think it's the least applicable of all these things to biology. But I do think what comes out of statistical physics that is really useful, if we can embrace it, is trying to make things as simple as possible. Of course, not simpler, but as simple as possible. I think some of the models that have been used in statistical physics, if not the techniques to study those models, are going to be useful in trying to understand complexity. But these are largely fragmented. And we'd like a unified theory, and we're starting to get one. So what I want to talk about is this relationship between complexity and robustness. I want to talk about a complexity phenotype, which we describe as robust yet fragile, and a complexity genotype, internally complicated. Okay, these are the things we're interested in. We've got this sort of new theoretical framework, and it's work that came out of collaboration with Gene Carlson here at UCSB, and those cast of thousands that I put up at the beginning. We think it applies to both biological and technological systems. So technology evolves from simple tools to then building machines that are very fragile out of very precisely machined components. So think of a 1798 steam engine or a 1650 clock. Very, very fragile mechanisms. Highly precisely machined parts. Advanced technologies use big, complicated architectures to hide all the complexity and to build robust systems out of sloppy components. CMOS at the analog level is junk. It's cheap and easy to make, and you can fabricate, you know, millions of transistors on a single chip, okay? But you have to organize that in such a way that you don't see the sloppiness that exists down at the label. And the problem is, these technologies are vulnerable to these cascading failure events. So the robust yet fragile phenotype is it's robust to large variations in the environment and the component parts. Fragile, often catastrophically so, to these sort of cascading failure events. So there's a trade-off between the ideal or nominal performance, which we talked about with respect to these proteins, and robust performance in the presence of uncertainty. So greater complexity from this point of view just means more extreme, robust, yet fragile characteristics. So I want to emphasize two things. It's primarily not robustness to genetic variation that I'm interested in here. It's mostly perturbations in the components of the environment. Not that genetic variation robustness isn't interesting, it's not the most important thing that I'm talking about here. And also, the cascading failures can be initiated by both small perturbations or large. You know, a single gene knockout can do nothing, or it can be completely lethal. And with the amount of material involved and the amount of energy involved is infinitesimal. Same thing with this laptop. Knock out the right transistor and suddenly things don't work. And the whole system doesn't work. So, but I can, you know, I can, this is crazy to do, but I can change the power supply, you know, I can change the temperature, I can do all sorts of things, I can run all sorts of garbagey software on it, and it keeps on working, mostly. Okay, so fragility is most interesting, of course, when it's not the, you know, bang you on the head, it's when I, you know, inject you with a virus. So what's the genotype here? The genotype is complicated. So you get a complicated genotype, which requires, so to get this robust phenotype and the robust fragile trade-offs, you end up with lots of internal structure, hierarchies, all these sorts of things. So far, biology, molecular biology has been about the simplicity of biology, what the parts are and how they interact. Now we want to think about the biological complexity. And the nominal function, the behavior in the laboratory, is going to tell you little. And again, this is things I've learned from biologists more than telling biologists. So we come back to this paradox, and we start seeing that it actually is very ubiquitous. We do this in engineering. So you build a big sloppy heater. You get a big heater, and you don't care really how much heat it puts out, or a cooler, how much. You want to make sure its sign is right. If you ask for more heat, you get more heat. Okay, and then you put a very precise thermostat on it. And the combination regulates the temperature. But you need this precise thermostat, and you can have a very sloppy heater. Okay. Now, if you walk into a room, what's the thing you're going to notice? You're going to notice the heater. And then a while later, you'll find that thermostat in the wall, and you go, oh, that's how the whole thing works. So I want to talk a little bit about airplanes for a minute. So how do we get airplanes to be nice and stable? So, airplane. Flies real nice. Okay, so the way it works is that it's got a mass in the front, a tail in the back. The mass in the front moves the center of mass forward, the tail in the back moves the center of pressure backward, and that gives you static stability. The problem is you get extra weight with the mass in the front that's not functional weight, and you got non-functional just drag elements in the back. Easy fix. Get rid of that. Of course, that's insane. You would never get on a plane like that, right? And no one would ever build a plane like that, right? Except that's exactly how we're building planes all the time now. These are existing planes that fly already. Whatever you think of this as a taxpayer, and as a taxpayer, I'm completely outraged by the existence of this vehicle. It's pretty cool, right? And you know how this flies when you turn off the control system? Like that. Okay? That's exactly how it flies. Just as well as this. And so there's all sorts of prototypes being built, designed and built. Well, most of these are military, but this is a commercial vehicle. This is a Boeing design. Probably never get built, but this is what Boeing would like to build. It's a better plane. It holds for the same space that it takes up, it holds a lot more passengers because you fill up the wings with passengers. Yeah. No, you don't have as many windows. So why do we love building robust systems from highly uncertain and unstable components? Why do we love to do this? Why do we do this? Why don't we just build robust proteins? Why do we go to all this trouble? So I want to try to give you some sort of theoretical story about why this might be true. We'll do a little bit and then we'll take a break. So I'm going to take this picture, and I'm just real simple. I'm going to imagine that this is a component. And I want my component to have some response, y, which is a function of the input r, the reference value r, and some disturbance. And I want to get rid of the disturbance, and I want to respond to r. So for now, I'm just going to assume everything is just numbers. I'm going to assume that p is uncertain, and also that the higher the gain of p, the more uncertain it is. So what I mean by that is I'm going to just think of these as numbers. So y is some p plus delta p times r. And then if p1 is bigger than p2, then delta p1 over p1 is bigger than delta p2 over p2. So the uncertainty is higher. If I have higher gain, I have more uncertainty. So just think about this. The harder I hit you, the less uncertain I am about exactly where and how hard I am going to hit you. So if I go out and just touch you, I can do that very precisely. But if I want to really clobber you, there's going to be some slop in it. And I, you know, of course, I make that trade-off depending on what I'm trying to accomplish. So now I want to think about what happens if you put such components in a feedback system. So we have this equation. Now the problem is y appears on both sides, so we can write it like that. And then I want to rearrange things. So y is now a function of r and d. We have this term s, which is this 1 over 1 plus gk. It's a sensitivity function. Again, this is undergraduate control theory. So what happens here? What if we choose g and k to have this relationship? G is a lot bigger than 1 over k, and 1 over k is bigger than 1. So k is small, g is big, but they have this relationship. Then the product gk is a lot bigger than 1. And then gk is a lot bigger than 1, so 1 over gk is really small. So s is a lot smaller than 1. And then y, s is a lot smaller than 1. So this looks about like 1 over k, and this looks like 0. Okay. So what we've accomplished is we've killed d. D doesn't matter anymore. D's gone. We've got rid of our disturbance. And we have this response, y equals 1 over kr. And k is very small. So we can build k very accurately. It's small and very accurate. So 1 over k is big and very accurate. Magic, right? So now we have a high gain, very accurate system. Magic. So our design recipe is we make g a lot bigger than 1 over k, a lot bigger than 1. So g is as big as we can make it. But if it's as big as we can make it, it's also maximally uncertain. So when we're going out there rummaging through our bin of parts, we take the highest gain, most uncertain g we can get, and then we hook it up with a small, low uncertainty k, and the result is high gain, low uncertainty, and we've killed the disturbance. The magic of feedback. That's why we love feedback. It's also probably why feedback control theorists like me have kept this a secret, because it's very powerful, and we didn't want anybody to know that we had this magic to work with. Yeah?
So dy dk has 1 over k squared in it, and since k is small, then the perturbations to even small errors in k will be magnified by 1 over k squared.
Yep. But still a win, because we can build a very precise 1 over k. It's like our thermostat. We can build a very precise k.
It has to be much more precise.
We'll do a little more carefully. This is a little sloppy. We'll make it a little more quantified. So this whole approach to you can have dynamics, multivariable, nonlinear, structured uncertainty, all of this what I just said can be extended to whatever you want. The problem is, to show anything, you got to compute, and the more you do of this, the more hideously computational it gets. So the idea is that what you're doing in these cases is you're getting this high gain, high uncertain G, wrapping it with some regulatory feedback loop, and the result is nicely robust. Let's give a little more detailed description of what's going on here. So let's think about this component, and now think of it as some nonlinear function. Okay, so P is some nonlinear function. We haven't put dynamics in yet. We'll put dynamics in, but nonlinear function. And we're going to assume it's uncertain, so it's in some cone. So we can put in a cone that's bounded by linear parts, okay? So the thing inside may be all messy. It might even be a relation. It might have hysteresis, whatever. But we can stick it in this cone, and we can bound it by P min at the bottom and P max at the top, okay? So now we have this cone, and we're going to draw a P max as a function of P min. And here's the idea, is that as it goes up, we get more uncertainty, okay? So this would sit right in there somewhere. So now we have high gain systems that are more uncertain and low gain systems that are less uncertain. Okay, so, and we have upper and lower limits. And so then again, this is just algebra. This is how we build actuators. This is how we build our heaters, and this is how we build sensors. So the actuator would be our heater, the deployed airbag, the big flaps on the airplane. The sensors would be the thermostat, the accelerometer, the accelerometer in the aircraft, the gyro in the aircraft. So the sensors tend to be small, very precise. The actuators tend to be big, powerful, and sloppy. Okay, there are human analogs. Okay, so what happens with negative feedback? Well, again, the same story. We go through the equations. Again, this is what I said before, but you can now we can just plug everything in and just compute it exactly. We don't have to make any approximations. And so if we do that, one over k would look like that, but that's not quite right. I'll fix this. I'll show you what the actual thing looks like. So what you'd use is this would happen if you'd used it had an infinite g. This is what the uncertainty would be like if you had an infinite G. But we don't have an infinite G. G can only be so big. So we take the biggest, most uncertain G we can get. We choose a K somewhere down there, and that's what we get. So you see that we get an improvement in a certain range over what would happen if we didn't use feedback. And this is exact, so this is not using the approximation. So you see, as you try to get closer and closer to G in gain, you don't do any better with feedback, right? You need that separation between G and K in order to get the benefit. Okay. So to get a moderate level of robust gain, you make an uncertain high gain and a precision low gain, and combine them in feedback, and then you get a big win there. And again, this works for nonlinear systems, dynamic systems, uncertain systems with all sorts of uncertainty in G's and so on. And most of robust control theory is about making this work in very complicated situations. So again, I claim it's not the best explanation for this, it's just the simplest. I think it's the simplest.
Excuse me, but it presumes that the small regulatory circuits have more precision than large ones.
That's right. Yes, that's true. So we can build precise thermostats.
No, in biology.
Yes, it's true in biology. Yes, that's right.
Because
so,
generally when there's small numbers of components,
yeah, and that's really interesting. So how does biology deal with the stochastic fluctuations? So in that sigma 32, the concentration, quote, concentration of sigma 3 sigma 32 is 0.1 molecules per cell. What the hell does that mean? We're trying to figure that out, right? We actually have to do the full stochastics, and that's why Dan Gillespie is here today. Dan, because he's an expert on that, and that's a critical element in this whole area. But huge amounts of uncertainty at the low, at the. So here's the paradox in biology, which it's another paradox, which we could resolve, I think. But another paradox is the most precision is occurring at low signal levels, where stochastic effects come into play, which makes you not so precise. And here's the deal. Think of the sigma 32. It's a lot easier for sigma 32 to measure, even at these low levels, measure the level of protein of denatured proteins, and also indirectly the chaperones, than it is to have the translational and transcriptional machinery produce a perfect amount of. So you still have this monotonic relationship between low gain and high precision. The problem is you still have to worry about what happens at the stochastic limit. And nothing I said here had any stochastics in it other than that little D disturbance. So the actual implementation of this, it's the same thing when you go, you know, when you look at the analog level on here, it's sloppy. So how do we get rid of the analog sloppiness here while we make digital devices? How does biology get rid of the analog sloppiness? The stochastic sloppiness, it actually does a lot of digital devices as well. So there's a lot of different mechanisms other than the one I've talked about. But that's a really important question.
But it seems for something like the have chromosomes get captured by microtubules, the exact analog to what you were saying would be that you would detect how many chromosomes have been captured by microtubules, and you regulate the rate at which microtubules are recreated.
No. No, that's not how you do it. What you do is you make microtubules go all over the place.
No, I know how it's done.
And they would have a sensor that detected a spot on a chromosome that had not been attached by a microtubule. Right? You want to sense something nice and local, right? I don't sense in my car, I don't sense that I'm in a crash. That'd be nice, but too expensive. What I sense is, have I got an excessive acceleration? So you'd love to sense something global about the state of the chromosomes, but you can't. Too expensive. So what you sense is something quite local about how a microtubule is connecting to the chromosomes, right? So primitive technologies build fragile systems from precision components. Advanced technologies build robust systems from sloppy components. So lots of examples. This is the most powerful mechanism, and also most dangerous. There's a long list of other ones that I haven't talked about yet at all, and I'm not going to. I'll mention them at some point. But there's a whole lot of other strategies that engineers use, protocols, digital systems, deliberate stochastic effects to basically game theory or team theory in situations where there's limited communication. There's all sorts of strategies that would come out of an engineering theory that seem to be used by biology. Question is, this looks like magic, right? So I take this stuff and I'm now flying around. And it's wonderful. What's the downside? One of the downsides is this extra complexity. Okay, so let me just, I'll talk about the downside and then I guess we'll take a break. So here's the dark side. Beware the dark side, Luke. Okay, so here's the dark side. I'm going to simplify the picture even further. I'm just going to talk about the feedback part, okay? So what I want to do is I want to kill D. So basically Y is 1 over 1 minus FD. And this is in the case, I'm just going to assume everything's numbers again for a moment. So if F is really big, I kill D. Good thing. High gain feedback kills disturbances. If these are just numbers, then this S I'll call the sensitivity function. So S measures my disturbance rejection. It's convenient to study log S. So let me say, negative F means F is negative, right? Then 1 over 1 minus F is going to get small. If S is less than 1, then log S is negative. So F negative, log S negative. That's negative feedback, and that's how disturbance is attenuated. The reason I'm introducing this is this generalizes to dynamical systems. This does not. Okay. So negative feedback attenuates disturbances. Positive feedback amplifies them, right? So log S negative means S is less than 1, means that D gets attenuated If S is bigger than 1, log of S is positive, and disturbance is amplified. If F was 0, then Y would be equal to D, S would be equal to 1, and we'd get neither amplification or attenuation. Now, so what happens is, we can plot log S versus F, and F negative causes log S to go negative, okay? And that's attenuation. If F is positive, positive feedback, we get this, an amplification. And notice that the amplification blows up. So this is one of the dark sides right away. You see that a bit of positive feedback gets you in a lot more trouble than the negative feedback. So you've got to avoid it, unless you want it. There's sometimes when you want positive feedback, but that's not what we're talking about right now. Okay. Now we're not going to, something else happens past there, we're going to sort of forget about that for a moment. So you get extreme robustness. That is, using feedback, we can drive S very, very small, log S very, very negative. But we also could have extreme sensitivity if F goes to 1. Okay, that's the danger. Now, here's the punchline. If these aren't numbers, but everything has dynamics, then Y and D are now signals, and F is some operator on signals. Okay? But we can still define S by taking the Fourier transforms of Y and D and taking their ratio. Okay? Now, if F happens to be linear, then this ratio is the same for all D's and Y's, right? It doesn't depend on D and Y. If F is nonlinear, then each D and Y give you a different S. That's the difference between linear and nonlinear. So nonlinear is a lot more complicated, a lot messier. But what I'm going to say doesn't depend on that. We're just going to take a D, take a Y, take their transforms, take their ratio. Okay. Now, under assumptions that are consistent with this being physical, that is actually causality. So by causality, I mean that the output of F can't anticipate its input. Okay. You can prove that the integral of the log of the magnitude is positive. Again, standard control theory result. So what that means, remember I said that log S negative is attenuation, log S positive is amplification. This says that those things are balanced. The amplification must at least balance attenuation in this sense. So every bit of attenuation you get with your high gain negative feedback is necessarily paid for by amplification due to positive feedback. Again, we can't really talk about positive negative feedback when this is an operator, so we have to talk about this. So that's the dark side. This is the dark, in this case the red side, but this is the dark side of feedback systems. Is that we want this, and we want as much of this as we can get, and the price we pay is this. This is probably a good place. Yeah, we'll do a lot. Yeah, well, in fact, yes, we'll do a little demo. So here's the idea. Here's the intuition. What your control system is, you're supposed to track me. And I have three positions. I can go one side, middle, other side. Okay? Now the problem is, you have a little delay, an infinitesimal delay. But so the point is, you got to point before I move. And you want to minimize the error between where you point and where I am. So, suppose I do the following motion. So I'm going to count. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. If you're going to try to do this, it'd be pretty easy, right? You just kind of, right? However, if I was going to do this, right, if I was going like this, then you'd have to go, right? Either way, if I switch behaviors, your error is worse than if you just stood there and pointed at me, right? So you can choose. You can be good at low frequencies or high frequencies, but not both. Actually, you can do both, but then you lose middle frequency. So there's a trade-off, okay? And what does nonlinearity buy you? Well, nonlinearity means that if I change my strategy, you can adapt. You could do something different over time. If you're linear in time invariant, then you just got to decide what I'm going to do and you stick with it for then on. And if I'm malicious and I can do anything I want, the best thing for you to do is just sit there and do nothing, because I will always beat you. But if I have some regularities in my behavior, okay, then you can win by choosing to exploit those regularities, provided they don't change. That's basically all there is to it. If there's any kind of delay, and there's always delay, and you can't anticipate what I'm doing, and the only way you can anticipate what I'm doing and take the right action is due to regularities in my behavior that you can exploit. And it makes you vulnerable to the assumptions that you've made about those regularities. So you get this robust yet fragile picture. So feedback is the most powerful strategy for producing robust behavior. Biology uses it gratuitously, much more so than engineers have traditionally been. We're starting to become more like biology and using lots and lots of it and making these big complex networks that hook up everything. So we get this situation, which in general, you can think about having different kinds of uncertainties. We just looked at uncertainties, basically the difference in uncertainty was just frequencies. But now we have, imagine all sorts of different uncertainties, and we get this situation, we're robust to what we know about and we're fragile otherwise. So this is probably a good place to stop. So feedback and robustness. So negative feedback is both the most powerful and most dangerous mechanism for robustness. It's everywhere in engineering, but it's hidden when it works well. So the more it gets used, the more it disappears until something horrible happens. And then they still blame the pilot, or the governor or something. Biology uses it even more aggressively than engineering uses it, which is interesting, but we're starting to change. We're trying to get as aggressive as biology. And we're also probably going to start having we'll probably start having biological levels of success rates with engineering, which means practically every organism that's born dies before reaching adulthood. Essentially every species that's ever existed goes extinct. You know, that's the future of engineering. Lots of other strategies. Positive feedback can actually be a good thing when you use it to build switches. Protocol stacks, feed-forward control, I mentioned that, randomized strategies and coding are all strategies that are used quite a bit. So, probably this is a good time to take a break.
Yeah.
And so when we come back, maybe I'll try to talk a little bit about chemotaxis and how we can use these ideas to sort out what's going on in chemotaxis.
Perfect. 5 minutes break.
System. Been working on systems.
Yeah.
In neural systems and now in genomics.
I guess we're going to start again.
Let's get going.
Yeah, I'd like to hear what your take is on this. But.
Whoa.
Yeah.
I've probably been getting recorded this whole time. What? I know, but at this time I was out in the bathroom and talking to people.
So you're talking about that recording?
Yeah, I was getting recorded.
Probably they saw it.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I think of it in terms of this research is it sort of sees this as sort of a design problem in terms of someone sitting back and sort of thinking, okay, how would I design things sort of in an optimal way? And I'm thinking of sort of how things, you know, arise. I think that, for instance, what happens with computer programs, you know, that you have a computer program that works more or less, and when it doesn't work, people do patches to pick things up. The old SBI just have a whoops score.
Yep, sure.
And so you could imagine the sort of all the feedback and all those type of things happening in terms of an incremental, iterative approach towards things.
Oh, that's maybe certainly how it is, yeah.
Than the design strategy approach.
Well, I think what my experience has been is that engineering has much less design in it than we imagine.
Yeah.
And biology is much more optimal than we would expect from a process as stochastic as mutation and natural selection would suggest. So one way of thinking about it is, certainly I'm talking about bacteria. I think we're just horrible kludges, and I'm not even thinking about humans. But if you think about bacteria, they get to swap genes and all sorts of things. And they've been doing, you know, they have a 20-minute life cycle, and they've been doing it for 4 billion years. So they've tried an awful lot of things. So the brute force approach seems to work pretty well. The other issue is, but there's a more important issue actually, a more important answer is it's not so much about saying how could we do this, but how must it be? If we want certain levels of performance and robustness, and I'll get into this in the chemotaxis story, there's only one way to do it. So either you do it that way or you die. So either you discover or design or come up with or whatever the right way to do it, or you don't function. And so it's sort of like, why do we take the tails off airplanes? Well, in the military context, easy answer. You fly the planes without the tails against the planes with the tails, and the guys without the tails win all the time. So if you went to some advanced planet that was warlike and insane like we are, and sufficiently advanced, you would expect necessarily to have no tails on the planes, because the guys who had the tails on the planes lost the war, they're dead, right? Of course, you know, that depends on, you know, large populations and stuff like that. Bacteria, huge population. So I think what I'm interested in is what's necessary. And the other thing is, as a starting point, one can think what is optimal and work back from there.
Yeah, and I guess my concern is, I mean, I know bacteria have been around for a long time, but there's questions about the ergonomicity of the solution space and things like that. You know, can you get there from here?
Yeah. I think it's a legitimate question. I think again, that was something that surprised me, is the more I understand, and there's been the long history in biology of going, oh, this is a hack. The whole heat shock thing, redundancy, doesn't really need to be there. Then I realized, well, what it protects against is you raise the heat. All of a sudden, all this stuff starts mattering. And so usually the things that have been thought of as kludgy or redundant or whatever in the context, and certainly in bacteria, are often later found out to be very well-designed regulatory networks to deal with some robustness issue. So, but I think I'm more interested in saying biology is this mix of necessity and contingency. Contingency has been heavily emphasized. I think balancing it with necessity is a good thing to do, and I think ultimately we'll find those in balance. Right now it's like this. Right now when we look at biology, we don't see much necessity, and I want to balance those till they come into balance, and I think we'll see a balance between them. I don't know how it'll end up. I think we'll be a lot of contingency, and bacteria will be a lot of necessity. Okay. So, this is just an aside. The stuff I'm talking about is really trying to find the simplest story, and it doesn't really reflect what I would say is current research. It's certainly in terms of the theory I'm talking about. One of the most interesting theoretical connections is between robustness, evolvability, and verifiability. I think it's one of the most interesting things about engineering and its connections with biology. These are things we want to be compatible, and it looks like they are. I'm probably not going to get to say anything about that. We're starting to get a more integrated theory of control communications and computing, exactly what we need in engineering. I think it'll be relevant to biology. So I've talked about this robust yet fragile story. Let me just sort of give you a sort of somewhat facetious example, but just to show you some other example other than this axis being frequency. So here is two kinds of uncertainty. Chess, playing chess well, and surviving large meteor impacts. Okay. So humans are pretty good at playing chess and not very good at surviving large meteor impacts. Okay. Well, you think, well, gosh, surviving large meteor impacts is hard. Well, it isn't really actually hard. So the archaea, which is our archaeobacteria, the really old organisms, they're not very good at chess. But they have absolutely no problem surviving a meteor impact that would vaporize the surface of the planet. That's, they live in rocks 2 kilometers down in the Earth, right? So they don't care what happens on the surface of the planet. So they have a more, again, this is a cartoon. They have a more uniform, robust, yet fragile profile. And they're less complex. So this is the essence of complexity, sort of a coefficient of variation associated with your sort of robust yet fragility, which again, this is all a cartoon. But the idea is that when you do this, you do this. So you can imagine, try to build an organism that would play chess and survive meteor impacts. You probably have to, you know, take a human and stick them in underneath the ground 5 kilometers, right? I mean, you have to do a lot of work, right? So we're trying to do that. We're trying to engineer a big organism, us and our machines. So we're trying to, we already got our machines playing chess better than us. So we're trying to build machines that will help us survive. So us with our machines will survive meteor impacts. So we're sort of a new meta-organism. And then the question is, what do we become fragile to then? What's the fragility in that scenario? Our machines, right? I mean, the machines malfunction. I'm not worried about like the Matrix, right? I'm worried. I think the thing wrong with that movie is that the plot should have been that this was the best thing the machines could come up with to keep humans alive. But that they're really on our side, and we'd screwed everything up, and the only thing they could do is put us in these little pods and keep us from destroying the planet any more than we already had. But the thing that I think the real danger is we turn everything over to our machines, and then they just don't work. Not that they, you know, enslave us. They only enslave us by just, you know, wake up one morning and nothing works. And it's all magic, right? Because it's all these big feedback regulatory networks. So engineers are faced with the same issues in forward engineering, the future of engineering, as biologists are in reverse engineering biology as we see it. Most of the diseases that we have to deal with are diseases of complexity. These are situations in which these regulatory networks are used against us. So cancer. Stem cells and even differentiated cells seem to have a gratuitous amount of pluripotency in adult organisms. Why? Gives us some regenerative capacity, right? The price we pay for preserving that regenerative capacity in adulthood is that regenerative capacity can be hijacked and you get cancer. We have very complex immune systems. The price we pay for that is sometimes that very complex immune system turns against us, and we have autoimmune diseases. These are diseases of even viral infections. Viruses hijack our regulatory machinery to some extent, and so these are diseases. So let's talk a little about chemotaxis to end up with here. So here is a cool picture of the various taxis an E. coli uses. So it all runs through the same motor, and there's all sorts of cool things about this. There's so much to learn here. There's so much yet to understand. So what you basically have is you have four chemoreceptors that are these transmembrane receptors. We're going to be focusing on this aspartate. So what these things do is they all bind ligands, and then they all use essentially the same conformational change in the cytoplasm side to transmit information over to the flagella. And so four of them are pretty similar. Then there's this really cool one up here that is used for aerotaxis, which is going after oxygen. Totally cool. If I get a little time, I'll say something about that. So most of these this one is for the different, they're receptors for different ligands. And the other thing these will do is they also sense temperature. So you can use these, the thermotax. So this is, the thermotax process uses these sensors. And then there's taxis based on actual transport of material as opposed to simply ligand binding. And so I'm not sure how many of these are there, Adam? Okay. Anyway, there's a bunch of these, I think. So we're going to focus just initially on this system, the aspartate system that's been studied the most. So this is sort of the picture for the aspartate. These are all, you know, I should have gotten permission to use these. I just pulled them out of papers online, like on the fly. And so actually I'm violating copyrights if I let you put these on your website, probably. I don't know. Anyway. So you have these receptors, and there's a network, and I'm not going to try to describe the details of this network. It's in lots and lots of papers. And if you go to the paper on my website that I pointed to, the paper in PNAS, this paper in PNAS, and then the references therein, and so on. You can see this. Okay. So this flagellum, this motor, is actually a rotary motor, and it's driven by the proton gradient that exists across the cell membrane. And one of the coolest things is if you go back to here, which I guess I'm not going to talk, I don't really understand very well, but this aerotaxis, it'll sit there and aerotax in a circumstances where it's going in and out of oxygen. So it's changed from anaerobic to aerobic mechanisms. All the time, it has to maintain this proton gradient. This proton gradient, when it's got oxygen, is being maintained by these NADH and quinine molecules in the membrane. And when it's anaerobic, it's using ATP synthase to run backwards to create the proton gradient. So it's doing this wild thing where it's regulating the proton gradient all the time while it's aerotaxing. It's really cool. So I don't understand how that control system, that's a control system, I really want to understand how that works. But we'll take this simpler one for now. Okay. So the idea is that you get ligand binding, there's receptors, and the way all these things talk to the motor is through this one key Y in its phosphorylation state. So key Y and its degree of phosphorylation determines how the motor works. So how does this thing, well, basically what happens is, as a first cut, you have a motor that creates motion moving you through ligand concentrations. So how does this work? Well, I'll try to do a little demo. So what happens is, you got these flagella, and if they rotate, this is not quite right, but it's close enough. If they rotate one direction, they push. If they rotate the other direction, they pull. Okay? So you change the direction of rotation. If you change the direction of rotation and they're pushing, they tend to bundle together and you take off in some direction. And then you reverse them and you stop and you kind of wander around like this, and then you push again and you go off in a new direction. So by doing that, in a sequence, I can get a random walk. I go for a while, I get a run, it's called, and I stop, I tumble, do it again, and I get a random walk. So now the problem is, this bacteria is so small that it can't sense spatial gradients. So it's sitting there and it wants to climb up a gradient, it can't sense, it's so small it can't sense spatial gradients. So basically it just kind of wanders around, okay? So that's the basic first part. This is again an example of gratuitously uncertain behavior, right? It's got this mechanism, this process, that can allow it to do random walks by alternating between running and tumbling. Okay, so how do you get to use that to go up a gradient? Well, you have a signal transduction mechanism that biases the random walk. So what happens is, when you're going in a good direction, you're tasting the environment, getting more stuff I want, you run longer. And then when you tumble, if you go, oh no, I'm going in a bad direction, you tumble very quickly. So consequence, you run when things are good, tumble when things are bad, and that biases the random walk and you move up the gradient. Now this is the only way this organism can do it. It can't sense space, so it has to sense change in concentration over time, and from that infer change in concentration over space, and then take the appropriate action. Larger organisms can actually sense space, but these guys can't.
Doesn't that make the random walk necessary rather than gratuitous?
Absolutely. It's the only way you can do this, is you have this uncertain random walk with feedback to create this biased motion. Absolutely. You cannot do it any other way. And this signal here is this key Y, and it's degree of phosphorylation is the signal. Now, in some very nice work and a whole series of work out of Liebler's lab that really kind of put the icing on the cake in terms of trying to understand how this picture works, is what they found is that the bias in terms of tumbling So the clockwise versus counterclockwise rotation of the flagella, and I'm really simplifying a lot, mostly because I don't understand a lot of the details of this, but basically it has this very, very sharp transition. Okay, so you're looking at, these are concentrations of the signaling chemical, and it changes just a little bit, and you go from always tumbling to always, or the other way around, I forget which is which, but it doesn't matter, it's just a sign. So you get this very, very high gain switch between tumbling and running, depending on this QY concentration. Okay, so there's some uncertainty in it. It's a little bit of slop, but it has this very, very high gain characteristic. So there's this network that does this signal transduction. What I want to try to explain is, again, the idea is this network has a bunch of features, and you gotta have them. They're necessary. They're not accidental. And you could sort of, you could, in some sense, you could have sat down and got a bunch of engineers and said, here are the constraints. You're really small, so you can't sense this, so on, so on, so on. And you would have had to come up with more or less this architecture. It's not, there's no choice. You've got to do it this way. So here's the basic mechanisms. And again, I'm going to just go through this quickly. This is hugely covered in the literature. I want to give you the big picture. And if you want it, you can go back and sort of sort this out from the papers. It's pretty clear what's going on. So what you have is you have ligand binding. So you got this transmembrane protein that causes the conformational change. And what that does is it changes the rate of phosphorylation of QY. Okay. So the fast dynamics are the process of binding and ligand and unbinding. So let's split this up into two pieces. This is the fast process. The ligand binds, it changes the rate of phosphorylation of QY and changes the rate of flagellar motor changes. So if you get less ligand binding or more ligand binding, you get an instantaneous change in this flagellar motor. So that's the fast dynamics. Got to be there. Makes sense. You've got to have that responsiveness. So here's what happens. On short times, you get a step change in ligand, and you get an immediate and very fast change in this QYP. And this extends the run. There's more ligand. This causes an extension of the run. And the way they do this experiment, of course, they tie the things down, and so then they watch the flagellas rotate. But if you were, so the idea would be, if you're going along and you hit a sudden change in ligand, of course you wouldn't, that's not a natural thing, you'd sort of hit a gradient. But you tumble, or you don't tumble, you'll run, you'll extend the time that you run. You extend the time you run by making, by having the amount of phosphorylation of QY go down. Okay. But that's not all that happens. There's this additional dynamics. And this is slow dynamics. And what this dynamics does is it turns out this protein has a lot of methylation states. And so it's got these other proteins that methylate and demethylate these states. What does that accomplish? Well, it accomplishes basically this. The long time response is you get a big change, and then it goes away. If you remove that methylation loop, the change stays. So here's a situation where we up the ligand, hold it, drop it. Up it, drop it. So that's the ligand at the top. And then what happens is the correct network has a big response, and then it goes away. A big response and goes the other way. Big response and goes. So this is what it's doing. It's saying, it's coming along. It says, run a lot. But then forget it. Tumble a lot. Forget it. Run a lot. Forget it. And if you don't have that methylation process in there, it says, run. Okay? Doesn't go back. Why does it do this? Again, it has to do this. The reason is, you don't care about the absolute ligand level. You only care about its rate of change. So this is an approximate, it's a low-pass differentiator. Right? So it's taking a time derivative in order to infer spatial gradients. It has to do this. It doesn't care about the absolute ligand level. So this is, think of this as an approximation to differentiating that signal. And because of noise and everything else, you have to low pass it. Okay. So what you really want is you want a low-pass derivative, and that's exactly what this does. And without that methylation feedback process, you don't get it. What's interesting is that this comes back very, very well. So the idea is, how do you build a robust differentiator, and why? So here's what happens is you have this, you do this tumble and extend the runs, and you don't do it if you don't have the methylation loop in there. If you knock it out, you get this other thing. And again, you can knock out this whole thing and the bacteria is perfectly fine if you feed it. In fact, if it's well fed, it doesn't even make the flagella. I mean that whole network is gone. Right? So there's an example where you can knock out that everything I showed you, you can just take all that out of the E. coli, just happy as can be. Of course, if it has to go and find food, it will lose out to E. coli that have this. So you can knock out, I mean, how many genes is that? 400? Big chunk of the genome. Just has to do this. Just to find food, find air, get away from heat. Get away from also bad stuff. It chemotaxes away from poison. So how does biologists call this perfect adaptation? You see it all the time. You see it in our eyes. You see it every, you know, a lot of biology does this, gets this, what they call perfect adaptation. Engineers call this integral feedback. Well, that's the way you implement it. Integral feedback is ubiquitous in both engineering systems and biological systems, and it's necessary for robust. So without even knowing how biology actually does it, we know it has to have a certain architecture. It must have a certain architecture in order for this to be a robot, to be able to build this. So integral feedback is all over the place. It's in cruise control in your car. There's 10,000 integral feedback loops in every every refinery. The internet, TCP, is approximately an integral feedback loop. So that's another, I don't know, 300 million integral feedback loops spread around. I mean, there are huge numbers of these things around. So biology uses it everywhere. I'm going to say, how does this relate to what I talked before about feedback? I'll get back to that. So, first of all, why is it so important for this to be so perfect? Why does it have to be so perfect? So it's not that everything is sloppy. Again, this is extreme robustness, otherwise fragile. But here's the situation. Remember, this motor has this very fine gain spot, right? So you got to keep this KYP in the responsive range of that motor. If you wandered off, if this stuff kind of wandered off, then this differentiation process wouldn't work. So you got two things going on. You're differentiating your time signal, and then you're running it through this extremely high gain that saturates on either side. So you've got to stay right in the middle of that gain in order for this thing to work. So this is your high gain actuator. So it's the same as airplanes. So airplane control systems, if we put the flaps back on this guy, the control systems, the flaps have the saturation, right? So so as you're going along and fighting turbulence and everything, the flaps are moving all over. But the control system makes sure that they come back they stay around the middle. That's what you're doing here. Same thing. You got this big actuator, but it saturates, so you got to keep it in the middle of its active range. So if you want this system to work, you have to build it this way, right? And the thing can either tumble or not, so you have to build that way. You don't have any choice about this. So then the other issue is that all of these things are working through the same thing, right? So what you've got to do is actually kind of take a vector sum of all the different temporal gradients you're getting from all these different sensors. So you can't have one of them saturating the system. So the idea is that suppose I'm chasing aspartate and I get into this high concentration of aspartate. I still want to be able to get away from heat. So if my aspartate system is saturated that actuator, and all of a sudden I get heat, I can't sense it anymore, or I can't actuate it anymore. So because of this tumbling bias system, it has to be built this way. Then finally, the question is, how do we actually implement it? Well, remember I said we want, so basically what we have to have is a feedback system that has infinite gain, right? because the sensitivity function is actually going to zero at DC. At zero frequency, we're actually getting perfect adaptation, which means that our sensitivity function has to be zero at DC. How do you do that? Use integral feedback. So you make f of s equal to some f hat of s over s. This is a Laplace transform variable. And you assume that f hat of 0 is negative. Then that means that f of 0 is minus infinity, which means s of 0 is 0. So literally, you put, remember, if you go back and remember your undergraduate Laplace transform days or Fourier transforms, 1 over s is a Laplace transform of an integrator. So what you have to do is you have to have a feedback system with integral action. A necessity. This is if and only if. Okay? So you have to build it this way. So without even knowing any biology, what is a methylation loop doing? It's implementing integral feedback. Okay. And so the first sort of connection I made with a biologist was after sort of they explained us how this whole system worked, and we came back and said, oh, well, it's got to be, the methylation loop has got to be implementing integral feedback. And in order to do that, it's got to have the following specific characteristics in the binding constants, in the rate constants. And it was Mel Simon, who's this really good biologist. He looked at me and goes, how could you know that? You don't, because he knew how much biology we knew. I mean, like, he knew we didn't know any biology. So how could we say something about the biochemistry of a receptor? Well, because it has to be this way. Must be this way. So you can read the paper and sort of see. So what this creates, so the idea is that if you're trying to reverse engineer these systems, bringing robustness into it tells you a lot more than any of the kind of nominal behavior. Because if you don't care about robustness, this whole system can be chucked. The sensors, the actuators, the signal transduction networks.
You make some predictions about the rate constants of the manipulation.
Yeah.
And is that consistent in the picture of the Fourier diagram?
Yeah, absolutely consistent.
They, if I understood correctly, they claim that they have robustness even though they allow some of these rate.
That's exactly it. Yeah, you want robust. Yeah, that's exactly right. And so what they did is they ran years of simulations and came up with this idea that that basically key B only demethylates the inactive or the active receptors, okay, which was a conjecture that I guess Surrett made a while ago. And so most biologists believe this, and I don't know why they don't just do the experiment, but most of them believe it. And but it was sort of this, well, we've simulated it and it seems to work. So they did all the hard work. I mean, all we did is look at the models that were in the literature and say, oh, it's because of this. It has to be this way. So it's completely consistent with the biology story that the biologists already believed. So all we added was that it has to be this way. And if they go out and measure that constant, it isn't what is predicted. Then there's another family of different ways you could build it that would involve different other combinations of constants. So it's kind of this parameterized family, and this is one of them, but it's the simplest one. So you could say, what's the simplest mechanism that implements this? It's the one that is in the standard conjectures by the biologists. So, yeah?
The problem is that when we try to think of some biologically plausible way of building a perfect integrator, whether with this methylation system or with the calculus motor control, that your generic system will have finite memory and won't be perfect to integrate, and then you have to tune something in order to make it perfect. I thought that my kind of libel was precisely the statement that we would not have to tune.
That's exactly right. Yeah, yeah, no, it's simple. It's
a prediction about kinetic constants is a prediction that.
No, it's the prediction is that certain constants have to be zero.
Okay,
right? Yeah, and that's and why is that the simplest strategy? Because that's a strategy where I just say this is zero, and then everything else can be sloppy. So that's the way an engineer would do it. We would say the way I build it is I make sure that some connection isn't there, because that I can build that robustly, and then every connection that is there is sloppy. So that's the architecture, and that's a critical, I'm glad you asked that, because that wasn't clear, and I didn't make it very clear. The connection with the biology is that the way you implement all these things is by making constants zero.
Right, that's true, but what you said, that you predicted some ratio of constants, was not consistent.
No, I'm sorry. Yeah, so what you predict is that certain things have to be zero. And then that creates an architecture, and then other things can vary. Now, there's other combinations that will produce the same effect, but they're more complex. So the first thing, the null hypothesis, is you say, what's the simplest way of building integral feedback out of this architecture? And the simplest one, you can derive sort of a priori from first principles. The simplest mechanism using this architecture is the one that has been speculated to be biologically correct. And the reason the biologists went was because we could say that without really knowing any biology. I mean, once you said what the architecture was.
I guess I just want to progress a little more because I'm a biologist and I'm taking conclusions on it. I initially got the same message about ratio. But what I understand you to say now is certain connections are forbidden to appear to have integral.
And it's more than that. And certain ratios must be large. Other things, that sort of thing.
Some things can exist and other things have to be big.
Yes, yeah, that's right. So it's not, let me just be, again, if you know that literature, then what you need is you need one constant to be zero. And then you have to have a bunch of them in sort of these extreme regions where they're either in saturation or linear range. I mean, it's all the usual, it's all the things that allow you to actually write down ODEs describing this and that you don't need stochastic chemical kinetics. So the fact that you can write down equations requires a bunch of assumptions. So you need those assumptions too. And again, they seem to be biologically plausible. So there's a long list of assumptions that are the simplest implementation of this. But the one that is the voiced assumption, as opposed to the one you just sort of take for granted that something is working in some saturated region, is that a particular rate constant has to be zero. And that's very buildable. And so apparently, I mean, engineers can build zeros really easily. Any other number you want is going to be uncertain. But zero we can build. Now, we never really get zero because there's always some leakage. And then, of course, if you make the chips really small, the leakage gets big, and all of a sudden the zero is not a zero anymore. But usually you can build zeros better than you can build anything else. So you try to build your robustness out of making things zero. That's right.
So,
yep.
Which contradicts with the math action and there are some ways in which molecules can be divided in such a way that the idea.
But the biologists believe, the biologists that I've talked to believe that such a protein is buildable. The question is yet unresolved as, is this protein built that way? But it is the simplest strategy that one could use. Mathematically simplest. And again, that's the danger is, something that's mathematically simple or elegant from an engineering point of view won't necessarily be the best strategy. But we're also already using a lot of biological constraints of the architecture. So we know that we have multiple methylation sites, that affects the activity. And so we're already using a lot of the biology in terms of how the architecture is. And then you're just saying, if you're given that architecture, you've got a couple constraints. Here's a way of thinking about it. You've got a bunch of constraints. Some of the constraints are about the known biology. The other constraints are the known behavior. And you intersect those two, and you have limited choices as to how it could be built. And then in that intersection, you say, what's the simplest, most buildable strategy, apparently, and it's the one that's been proposed. Yeah?
You're saying, one thing I've been thinking about, you're saying that some of the constants have to be zero, some may have to be saturated. How robust is your integral controls to those conditions?
Well, you can check it. That again requires more sophisticated machinery. So what it ends up is there's little epsilons floating around, and what ends up happening is those epsilons turns into little epsilon errors in the perfect adaptation. So you never get, there's no such thing as a perfect integrator. And so if you have, think of it, 1 over S instead of 1 over S, you get 1 over S plus epsilon. So there's a little bit of S plus or minus epsilon. It might be a little unstable. So an integrator is never perfect anyway, even if you go out and build an op-amp. It's got a little leakage.
Yeah.
It's that leakage, that 1 over epsilon, then shows up. That's my big G gain, right? So it shows up, and you can work through the theory and figure out exactly what it is. So you can figure out exactly the price you pay for non-ideal integrals. It's just that you have to go through some more math. And again, this is sort of the zeroth order approximation. You say, put integral feedback in, you get perfect adaptation. Then as you deviate from perfect, but you still get this high gain feedback attenuation of the variation. So as you vary away from, as you're 1 over s plus epsilon, you still get this high gain effect. You just get 1 over epsilon instead of infinity.
I guess it doesn't follow some law anyway.
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't have, it just has to, you have to, you know, you have to stay in this region and it has to be awful. Because if you actually look at what's happened, it's fluctuating all over the place. So you kind of just got to get back into that middle part. So one of the questions is, this is the kind of question that has been, you know, is it fine-tuned or robust? And I claim that's just not the right question, right? It's fine-tuned for robustness. So every bit of robustness you have to tune for, and you pay for that robustness with fragility somewhere else. And so the question is necessity. How networks must be in terms of robustness, and then what the price to pay fragility. Now, you can make networks that are just fragile, okay? We can make software that's just fragile. So you can do bad designs, but if you're doing good designs, then robustness and fragility are these things that have to be, you know, these things you have to play with. And you put your fragility, somewhere where it's rare, safe. So this chemotaxis system, you could fool this chemotaxis system. You could get it to go in the wrong direction. But that's so unlikely in natural occurring gradients and circumstances that it's so rare that it's a good bet. Okay, it's probably a good time to stop. So I come sort of, of course, what we'd really like to do, I mean, this is a horribly complicated network. And what's going to be interesting, I think, is how this network interacts with, this is so interesting. Let me just say something about this. And I'll just take a couple minutes to say something about this. Because this might get you to actually, if you're interested if you love math, go read the thesis about this, because it's really cool. So what I've claimed is that ideal performance and robustness are in conflict. If I want a robust system, I have to give up a little bit of the ideal performance under ideal circumstances. So if I want a Formula One race car, it's going to be fragile, okay? And if I want a really robust tank, it's going to go a little slower in the Formula One race car, right? There's a trade-off between being really robust and being really high performance at a nominal ideal circumstances in the lab, in the wind tunnel, in the ideal circumstances, okay? What you might think is that evolvability, which is a kind of robustness, it's can you take your system and change it to make it robust to novel perturbations? In biology, it's clear what we mean by evolvability. In some sense, we think of robustness as how are you right now, evolvability is how well can you change. Verifiability is very important in engineering. It's not enough to be robust. You want to be able to verify that you're robust. You want to be able to prove that your system. I mean, I don't want to get on a Boeing airplane because they've had a good track record. I want to get on a Boeing airplane because I know the engineers and how they designed the airplane, and they have some systematic process that, you know, more or less gets them in the ballpark, right? And then there's the confirmation that no Boeing 777 has had any fatalities, right? So I'm willing to get on that plane. So there's two bits of information. I wouldn't be as likely to get on the airplane if I didn't know there was some verifiable process behind it. I wish it was more verifiable. Now, in biology, where does verifiability come up? Well, it's just comprehensibility. It means that the system can be reverse engineered and understood. So verifiability in engineering means we build a system, we understand it, and we understand how it works. We know where the fragilities are. We know where the robustness is. And we know that the fragilities are in places where catastrophic failures can occur, but they're going to be rare, and we're willing to pay the price. Okay. Now, you can imagine that robustness, evolvability, and verifiability are in conflict as much as robustness is with performance. And because I've said that robustness and fragility have this trade-off, that suggests that revolvability would be lost when you have robust systems. This is interest to biologists because there would seem to be a trade-off between building systems that are robust to the current environment but evolvable to new ones. Turns out that trade-off really isn't there. These things, robustness, evolvability, and verifiability, seem to be compatible and in conflict with nominal performance. Typical designs tend to be headed in that direction. That's been a tradition in engineering, is to build systems that aren't robust as they could be. Well, this was a talk in the context of computer science, and so certainly computer software is demo, get it out the door, get market penetration, and don't care if it crashes. That's been the style. So in that context, there is a contrast though. IP. IP was designed for robustness, not evolvability, and it's been the most evolvable, scalable, unbelievable design from the point of view of scalability that we've ever seen. I mean, IP was designed when there were 20 computers hooking up, and now there's hundreds of millions of computers and a million routers. Astonishing scalability. And it was not, scalability was not a consideration in the design. Robustness was. And it got the evolvability for free. So what Gerhardt and Kirshner have been arguing in a somewhat informal manner is that evolvability is also a consequence of robustness. You get some evolvability for free. And so one of the things we've been trying to do is make this more rigorous. And the theory involves combinations of robust control, computational complexity, particularly co-NP and convex and stochastic realization, semi-algebraic geometry, and semi-definite programming. But we think there's lots of examples from biology and engineering to think that there's some reason to believe there's a theoretical base. Lots of anecdotes. Now we're beginning to get a theory that says that, and if you wanted, that's the place to look, is that thesis that I told you about as a starting point for this whole issue. But I think this is going to be a tremendously interesting pursuit. It's particularly of importance for systems with a lot of embedded software, which is what we're building a lot of. But I think it's going to be relevant to biology because hopefully the idea is that because the organisms around us are robust and evolvable, they will be comprehensible. A priori, there's no reason to believe that. It sounds like paradoxes because I said systems that are robust are cryptic. They seem simple, but they're very complex underneath. But when you look at them from the point of view of robustness, then the verifiability actually drops out, apparently. And so this is a real new research problem. We've just been starting on this and have some theory that supports this. But this is, again, a question. This is a subject that's really, really in its infancy. And the methods for verifiability, if you know anything about software verifiability, they're extremely clunky. And we now think we see ways of pursuing that. But again, this is a beginning of a research program. But it does support the Gerhardt and Kirshner story. So
for something like the precision of adaptation, that's robust to genetic perturbation. So how is it evolvable?
Yeah. So let's think about how else one might architect. I'm talking about, so when I talk about robustness, I'm talking about the robustness of an architectural choice versus an alternative architecture. Okay. So the alternative architecture would be, for example, not to chemotax, not to have all of this. What could you do instead? What could you do instead of that god-awful network? Well, some organisms don't have that, right? Some organisms don't have any of that. They don't have flagella, they don't have any of these receptors. So you can sort of imagine my sort of toy E. coli in which we take this and knock it out, knock out everything. That's an organism that would beat an E. coli in certain environments. Okay. Now, what does this organism have as an evolvable capability as opposed to robustness? The organism with this stuff in versus the one without it.
Right, but I think this means you have to be very careful about definitions, because one definition of evolvability is the amount of system change you get when you mutate things.
right?
Oh, that's not what I meant. I'm sorry.
Right,
okay.
But I think it's important to be clear about the definition, because by that definition, they're clearly in conflict.
Yeah, so what I was using evolvability to mean was this system is built to keep attacks in an uncertain environment. What capability does this architecture for doing that give you to do something entirely new? And for example, suppose you didn't have this aerotaxis receptor. You're getting an awful lot of reuse between that and all these other receptors. So once you've gone to an architecture that allows you to chemotax, adding aerotaxis, evolving aerotaxis is presumably a lot easier. Once you've had one receptor complex, evolving a new one because of the modularity is a lot easier. Now, if you knock this all out and replace it with sporulation process or whatever, some other mechanism that's more kind of brute force, less regulatory, that will be less evolvable in the sense that you can't swap in new modules. So the nice thing about this architecture, so think about the architecture of feedback versus not.
Right, but you're...
So the feedback architecture, I can swap in a different sensor, and I can swap in a different actuator, and mix and match those, or I can evolve that. The other thing is I can evolve that sloppy actuator to do something new, because I'm relatively robust to changes in that. So what I'm talking about is when I make a choice of an architecture, and I choose that architecture for robustness.
You're really talking more about interchangeability than you are about unbolting things on, than you are about changing the performance of the components that are embedded in the system as it is now.
Not exactly.
All the things you were just talking about were about bolting things on.
Yeah, but also the pathway to it. So the idea is that if I have, again, if I have, think of this GK feedback system. The G, because I'm robust to variations in it, not only am I in short time scales exploring a lot of behavior in the dynamics, if I start mutating it, I can explore mutations of it. So the space over which I can evolve this architecture, the genomic space over which I can evolve this architecture versus the straight-through architecture. So just those choices in architecture. The straight-through architecture, if I change that, I immediately change my performance a lot.
Right. In the extreme, you can explore a wider range. But the point I'm trying to make is that in the over modest perturbation, having the feedback architecture means that when you make changes in the actuator, you get less changes in performance than you get with a straight through.
Exactly, that's correct, yes.
Right? So
that's right.
Talking about different.
You get, you, yes, you get, you. So what with this architecture, if you tweak this, you get fairly small changes. If you tweak this, you get enormous changes. You can get big leaps in phenotype space by changing this. So you get this combination, which, again, what's its ramifications? I don't know.
Right, but in the example you just gave, the component that's where you're robust is the component where you can't do things in evolution, the big thing. And the component that when you make small tweaks, you get big changes.
Is the sensor.
Right, and you're not robust to changes in the sensor.
So right, so the sensor would be, this would be the sensor.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's not the way, the way to think about it is, this architecture versus this architecture.
Right. Well, I mean, right.
So the question is this architecture?
Worrying about evolvability. Yes.
Yeah. Is this architecture?
Right. But I'm just talking about looking within circuits. Where?
But these trade-offs, you're not going to see at the component level. You're only going to see it at the system level. So the trade-off is between robustness of this versus this, and evolvability of this as a system versus this as a system, and this as a system is more evolvable because I get small tweaks here make big differences, and the small tweaks here that create novel sensors still don't screw up the big actuator in the back end here, right? Yet we're still pretty robust to this whole downstream process. So it's the architecture, going from this architecture to this architecture, which gives you more evolvability and robustness. That's the argument. And again, proving that and making that argument complete is going to be a long research project. It's just that's a direction.
Right. The second point I'm trying to make is that that's exactly different from the way LIDAR
Yes.
But I was just using where robustness and controllability locally would serve as a solution.
Right. And so that's why I said at the beginning, my notion of robustness and evolvability is a little different than some of its usage. And so my use of robustness is robustness both particularly the environmental changes, but also to the sloppiness in the components. And then my evolvability question is how can you adapt to very large changes in the large changes in the environment that you'd want to make systematic and long-term changes to. And that's what I mean by evolvability. And it is, I agree, it's a little different. It's more of an engineering use of robustness and evolvability of technologies. But I'm suggesting that it might be a useful way to think about biology. But again, it is the way Gerhardt and Kirshner seem to be moving. And they are explicitly denying any connection with technology. So they thought it's not that they were looking under the light under the lamp because that's where the light was. They came up with this description of the relationship between robust evolvability, completely independently of any technology perspective, because they explicitly say we don't think technology is like this. And so I'm taking the other point. I'm saying technology has to be this way, and I think biology has to be this way for the same reasons. But if I'm right or not is complete, who knows? I mean, it's a long research program to try to figure that out. Yeah?
I think I wanted to ask exactly that question. In what way can what you say about biology be wrong? Can it be falsified?
Oh, yeah. So the way it would be falsified, well, we just go to this picture. So I can make up engineering systems that are robust and unverifiable and unevolvable. I can make them. This isn't perfect. These are not lined up. There's a gap here. They're not exactly the same. Okay? So I know I can make systems that are robust, that are brittle as hell if you try to evolve them, and completely cryptic and unverifiable. You can't test that they're robust or show that they're robust.
You mean that they're getting away from biology?
No. So now. So the question is, we could come across a biological system that was like that.
So yesterday we heard about chemotaxis in pigs, and I guess we don't quite know how that system works.
Right, because it actually senses spatial gradients.
Right. So, as an engineer, can you predict how it should work? And presumably, in a couple of years, we'll know how it does work. And can we use that as a data point?
Well, again, what do we predict from this? We predict an equivalence class, right? So what we do is we say, based on what we already know from biology, and based on what we know about its behavior, and again, the more we can think about its robust behavior, the more perturbations we can see it deal with, the more things we see it do perfect adaptation to, then we create an equivalence class of possible things to build. That's an infinite equivalence class because you can make it more and more complex. And then the idea is that you say, in this equivalence class, it's kind of think of it as a cone of possibilities. And all I'm saying is most of the space that's pruned away as not being possible is due to robustness considerations. So I get this cone of possibilities. I say, what's the simplest thing? You go out and check. Probably not the way it's done. Why not? Because there was another robustness consideration that you didn't know about because you never tested it that says you can't build it that way. Right? And so the problem with this is the predictions that you make are, this is the simplest mechanism consistent with what we know. It's unlikely to be true because what we haven't done is we haven't put in ultraviolet light. And this doesn't work because this mechanism doesn't work if there's enough radiation. And so we have to use this mechanism. And so the process of discovery here will go, I think, by taking all the constraints you have, saying what the simplest mechanism is, and then saying, what is the experiment that will falsify that speculation? And you do the experiment and falsify it. But usually what that falsification will involve is a novel perturbation to the organism that hasn't been tried before. And so you perturb the organism in a novel way that the organism experiences in the real world but hasn't yet experienced in the laboratory environment. Then you write your paper and you falsify that. Now you have a new constraint. Then you say, subject to that, what's the simplest mechanism that's possible? And you move out in this sort of complexity cone, getting more and more complex structures. So that's how I think this process. So it's not, how can this process not work? This process cannot work if I put in everything that biology is really doing, and it's way far away from the simplest structure. If it's, you know, baroquely complex, not just cryptically complex because of robustness, but gratuitously complex in a truly gratuitous way. So think Windows. Is it like Windows? If it is, we're never going to understand it. You could not reverse engineer Windows, because inside it's got MS-DOS, and you're going, why the hell is that there? So if biology is like some of engineering, we will not be able to reverse engineer it in a systematic way, and we're just going to have to do every god-awful experiment. We'll have to do every experiment you can possibly imagine, and it won't be verifiable. So the point is, biology may not be comprehensible. And certainly parts of biology won't be. And those are the places where contingency plays such a huge role that all this necessity view just gets lost in the contingency. Yeah?
I wanted to, kind of picking up on that, I wanted to go back to what you were saying about robustness to uncertainties that are coming and how we're sort of making biological progress now. So for instance, if you have an engineered system, cars going down the highway, you have a pretty well-specified problem. You know that people's vision changes as a function of light. Sometimes people drink. You know that humans are bags of water mostly, so we need a care bag. And maybe we have this for a subset of biological problems. So if you ask Berg, he knows that at low Reynolds law numbers, cold is moving around and it's not long enough, as you were saying. But he'll freely admit that he doesn't know what's going on in the elementary canal when the bugs are there. So from your perspective, would you rather have clean and explicit specification of the problem or the statement of the problem, or would you rather have complete specification of the system? You know, so Andrew might say that cell division is replication and segregation, and we could try to understand that from that perspective,
yep.
But it's really, really rare that we have an understanding like that right now.
Right.
So
right.
Which would you rather see progress there? We're also not very good at systematizing, or rather systematically generating that sort of knowledge.
That's a really good question. I think what you need is you need a balance between the two. So the idea is that if you have lots and lots of component data, then the thing you desperately need is system level behavioral characteristics in an uncertain environment. If you have lots of observations, I mean, about behavior in lots of different environments, then what you'd need is component data. Because the idea is, think about, there's this huge space of possibilities. And every time I find some characteristic of a component, I mod out a whole bunch of possibilities. And every time I get a robust behavior, I mod out by something. So what we want to do is really get it from both ends. We want to be able to... And it's the back and forth, because what'll happen is you'll kind of get stuck over here on the behavioral side, and you go, what I really need to know is, are these methylation levels really all the same? Come on, go tell us that, because I'm not going to go and do a lot more experiments. Or on the other side, you go, we're kind of stuck here. We need to understand what this architecture is for. What possible perturbations is this network being robust? So it's the back and forth. If you do either one by itself, I think it's hopeless. Because there's just neither, to some extent, this is getting very hand-wavy and cartoony, but they kind of give you orthogonal directions in this space to mod out by. And so the system level picture and the component level picture are very complementary in what they tell you about what can't be true about the system you're studying. So I think both of them, but one or the other, I can promise you that if you only have the component level understanding, you'll never understand complex systems because they're deliberately robust yet fragile. They're extraordinarily fragile to some things, extremely robust to others. And if you don't know what that trade-off is, you don't know what to put your high fidelity simulation in. So are you going to simulate every atom in an E. coli? Well, no. So where are you going to put your effort? So both are needed.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.